BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Frank Muir, Dillis Powell, and Dennis Norden. Here's round one to try and test their respective vocabularies. Two marks if they get the meanings of these words right. Anne Scott-James, what is a Bethesda?
Oh, goodness. It's something Welsh.
Yeah.
Something Welsh. Yeah. A chapel, is it?
Yes. Oh. Which particular
church? Methodist, I should think.
All right, that'll do. Bethesda is a nonconformist chapel. It comes, in fact, from the New Testament and John 5:2, where the sick and the crippled lay in the chapel. But you find it often in Wales, as you find the alternative word, which is Bethel. And it's a Hebrew word meaning a house of mercy. Frank Muir, and go carefully here, what are the Nates? N-A-T-E-S.
They are what posh ladies wear at night.
No, you won't score on that. It's a lovely idea.
There's some kind of god, do you think?
No.
Deities?
No.
Frank, birthdays?
Frank, you're sitting on yours.
Oh. Eh? Is it,
yeah.
Buttocks?
Yes, absolutely right.
Really?
Very good question, but what an answer.
One out of two. Native.
No, I've got both. Just right. Reaching over for a whiff.
Two halves making one. The buttocks. And it could be, if you didn't want to think about them, as some people don't, the anterior pair of optic lobes in the brain. But you're not sitting on those. One out of two. Dennis Bauer, what is or was a real? R-E-A-L.
A-real. It's a royal.
Yes, it's a royal of a particular kind.
A royal coin.
Mm. From where?
Spain.
Okay, you're...
That's clever.
Two marks it is. It's a former, it doesn't exist now, I think. Former silver coin, and it could be at a lower value, a base metal coin, used in Spain and in other Spanish-speaking countries. And as Dillis quite rightly says, it means a royal coin. Dennis Norden, what's the meaning of beneaped? B-E-N-E-A-P-E-D, beneath.
Well, the only bit of that I recognise is the word neap.
Yes.
In the middle, which is some kind of tide.
That's a good clue.
It's something to do with a spring tide, I think. If you're beneath, you're caught in the spring, as with a very old sofa.
Yes, leave the spring aside for the moment, Dennis.
Really have no idea what
it
a neap
is. It must be a small tide. What is the high tide of the year called?
Yes, you're getting
that.
Cool.
It's the opposite to that.
That's it. You've got it already.
Christmas.
No. Anyhow, it's the smallest tide of the year.
Yes. Yeah. Beneath means you've been left aground, which Dennis never is, by a neap tide, which is the one that comes least high and goes lowest. So a ship neaps when it's prevented from getting away from land by the neaping of the tides. One and a half. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I hope that the two women members of the teams will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "Profuse strains of unpremeditated art." And Dennis Bowen and Frank, yours is, "There are fairies at the bottom of our garden." And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round two is about origins and derivations. Three marks this time, because I want members of the team, first of all, to give me the present meaning, And then say where that meaning comes from, the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Anne Scott James, mausoleum.
A mausoleum means a tomb, does it not?
Well, sort of how big?
It's a very large tomb.
Yes.
And it comes from the tomb erected to, was it by Mausolus of Caria or to him by his wife? To him by his wife, Artemisia.
Well done. It means nowadays a very magnificent tomb. It can mean almost any kind of vast, gloomy structure. But Anne is right. Mausolus was the king of Caria, and he died, and his wife Artemis was heartbroken, so heartbroken, in fact, that she drank his ashes mixed with water, which I don't recommend to you, and then erected this enormous tomb, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Frank Muir, the thin red line.
Thin red line means the British army in battle, in the glory of the British Empire, the rather brief period. I used to think it was the time of the Battle of Waterloo, but it's much later,
yes,
actually, isn't it?
Yes.
It was the Crimea.
Yes, quite right.
The phrase was applied, and it was applied by, my memory is right, the Times correspondent, Mr. Russell.
Well done, Frank. 3 marks it is. Absolutely right. Thin red line means a line of British soldier heroes, and this very distinguished war correspondent of the Times, Sir William Russell, reported the Crimean War. And when he wrote about the Battle of Balaclava, he said, the Russians dashed on towards that thin red line streak, tipped with a line of steel. Dillis Powell, count down, one word, count down.
Count down is usually applied nowadays to letting off a nuclear missile.
Yes, it could be. And by origin. And this is in your world. It's the world of film. And you know the chap very well indeed. It's a long way back in the late 1920s.
Fritz Lang?
Yes.
I don't remember the film.
All right, 1 out of 3, because you know what it means now. Mm. Countdown is the technique of counting from a higher number down to 0, instead of the other way around, which most of us non-mathematicians do. And it is used nowadays, particularly when launching rockets, or presumably if you had to fire an atomic bomb, you'd do the same thing. But it comes from Fritz Lang, in one of his earliest science fiction films, which I saw in Germany at that stage, called The Woman or the Lady in the Moon.
Yeah.
And he invented this idea, thought it would be more exciting for the audience, of counting down from 10 to 1 to naught before this rocket took off.
Well, it's nice to know.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
Dennis Norden, jaywalker.
Well, a jaywalker is a pedestrian. I don't think it is an offence over... It may be an offence over here, but I know in America and certain other countries you can walk dangerously in a road, same as you can drive dangerously. And the pedestrians who do that are called jaywalkers.
Yep.
Well, it would be jay. Jay was a sort of Victorian word for a silly person. I think it was short for juggins, actually. Mm. They'd call people juggins or... You know, he's a jay, they would say. And I would think it just means a silly walker, something like that.
That's all right. Yes, it's quite good enough, that. 3. It means a careless pedestrian who is reckless in traffic. And this is a funny word because it originally comes right back in the 16th century. It's used in Shakespeare as a simpleton, as Dennis infers. And I think it was imported into America probably with the early colonies and has come back to us in this phrase of jay walker because... For the Americans in the 19th to 20th century, the word jay means the same as hayseed. That is a country bumpkin who can't manage town traffic. We go on to a round of names and nicknames and titles and odds and ends and things. 2 marks again. And we begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what's the connection between Pride's Purge and the Rump?
The Rump Parliament. Is anything to do with
right.
that?
It's to do with the lower chamber.
Well, it all sounds rather 17th century.
It did, yes.
After the end of Cromwell's period, was it not?
It finished then, but it started much earlier. Did it? Something happened to the Long Parliament, and it became the Rump Parliament, and this is where the connection is.
Well, Pride's Purge happened to it.
Pride Purge happened to it, we think, yes.
And what was Pride's Purge?
Well, that's
there's a gentleman called Pride, who was a sort of creature of Cromwell's, who decided that Cromwell must run the country more or less of his own, and he rather emasculated or castrated the powers of Parliament.
Well, 1.5 out of 2. We've got mostly there. This was the occasion when Cromwell sent an army officer, Colonel Pride, with a file of soldiers to purge the Long Parliament of those who were in favour of Charles I. And the remainder, the rest of Parliament, which was left, was known as the Rump, because it was only part of the original Parliament. Frank Muir. And Frank, please, what was the Habeas Corpus Act?
Habeas Corpus was an act in law, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And it required the body to be produced. It's
why?
Corpus, you see.
Yeah.
Those of you who've rubbed up against Latin will recognize the corpus. And it was a great breakthrough in common law, because previously to the Habeas Corpus Act, your corpus could be habed and you could be endurance vile for as long as a baron or somebody wanted, and nobody could get you out. And then wise and humanist chaps passed this Habeas Corpus Act, which said, which means that a solicitor or somebody can get a habeas corpus writ, and the lord or the baron has got to produce the body from the dungeon in order that his friends may talk to him and his defence may be prepared.
Good enough.
I rest my case, Milan.
I think that'll do, Frank. It's jolly good. 2 marks. Just so that the lawyers don't counterattack me, this was a particular act of Parliament in 1679, Lord Shaftesbury brought it in, that every prisoner should be brought to trial so that a writ could be issued requiring his body to be produced, as Frank quite rightly says, in order that the lawfulness of his imprisonment could be investigated. It came in Charles II's reign after the Popish plot, and it means, I hear that you have the body, please produce it. 2 marks. And now to this power. Who said, had it been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed? And what was he talking about?
He was talking about Cleopatra's nose.
Well done. And do you remember who said it?
Something like Pascal.
Yes, well done. Got your marks. 2 marks, well done. Blaise Pascal, who was a mathematician, physicist, moralist, talking about the history of the ancient world, said, had Cleopatra's nose been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed. The tremendous results brought about by her beauty in enslaving Mark Antony, and so that Octavius Caesar won and not Mark Antony. 2 marks. And finally, Dennis Norden, for what will you always remember Hall and Knight?
I'm still in the process of remembering that terribly useful phrase, I hear that you have the body, please produce it.
Taking it too soon.
Hall and Knight is school.
Yes.
Maths.
Which bit of maths?
There was school book. Algebra, I think, yeah.
Hall and Knight wrote a famous textbook on algebra, which was inflicted on generation after generation of schoolchildren. I don't think it is now. And the short title was always Hall and Knight. And now we come to the last round, and we go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Anne Scott James, please give me the origin of the quotation, profuse strains of unpremeditated art.
I should think it is the Skylark, is it?
Yes.
Shelley.
Yep. 2 marks you get. Dennis Bowell, can I have the origin of yours, which was, there are fairies at the bottom of our garden.
We think it's Rose Fireman.
It is Rose Fireman, a poem just called, simply, Fairies. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so, back to Dennis Norden and his quotation, profuse strains of unpremeditated art.
Before embarking on this strange and chilling tale. There is a bit of information about it which I must give to our overseas listeners because they don't know this bit. We have in this country, on the radio, every week, a program called Desert Island Discs. And it's run by a man called Roy Plumley, who has a voice as soothing and persuasive as satin bed sheets. And what he does is he invites well-known personalities to say what 8 gramophone records they would take with them were they to be wrecked on a desert island. Well, with this in mind, you're now in a position to appreciate the full tragic import of this story, which is a message. It's in the form of a message which was taken from a bottle which was washed up recently on one of our South Coast beaches. I'm going to read you the message in full. It reads, "Help." But it doesn't go, it goes on beyond that. So, "Help," it says, "it is now 3 years that I have been marooned on this desert island. Never shall I forget that awful night when our ship went down. There were 80 of us aboard the SS Precarious. Within minutes of our ship striking the huge rock, the first mate was standing at the rail saying, 'Travel now, pay later, passengers, into the lifeboat first, then women and children. And all be of good cheer.' This area abounds in desert islands." Well, it would require a more eloquent pen than mine, and as I'm writing in octopus ink, a less messy one, to record the scenes of terror and confusion which then ensued. The pitiful cries of, "Never mind a life jacket, where's my 8 records?" Fear-crazed passengers trampling each other underfoot in their frantic efforts to get to the ship's record library. For my own part, I must admit that my first thought was to thank Providence that I'd had the foresight to keep strapped to my thigh the fully transistorized twin-speaker auto-change record player, which had been there since we left Tilbury Dock. I hadn't even taken it off during that pleasant interlude under number 3 hatch with the lady from the sick bay. Consequently, by the time I arrived at the remaining stack of records, the ship was already listing dangerously, so it's a question of grabbing the first 8 records I could lay my hands on, then leaping into the boiling deep and striking away in a steady breaststroke, which is not that easy when you've got 8 records in one hand and a fully transistorized auto-change twin strapped to your thigh. Dawn, however, found me on this lagoon, sprawled on the beach. I proceeded to examine my 8 records. I looked at the first one. It was Tom Jones singing, "It's Not Unusual to Be Loved by Anyone." Good. I looked at the second record. It was Tom Jones singing, "It's Not Unusual to Be Loved by Anyone." I looked at the third record. It was Tom Jones. I looked at the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, the eighth, and my mouth opened in a great howl of despair. I had 8 records of Tom Jones singing, "It's Not Unusual to Be Loved by Anyone." All the same. Obviously, what had happened was it was such a popular record, the ship had laid in a multiplicity of them, and I'd grabbed the whole stock. Gentle reader, it is now 3 years that I have been here alone. I've given up all hope of rescue. I know I am doomed to stay here. The only human voice, Tom Jones, singing, "It's Not Unusual to Be Loved by Anyone," singing it over and over and over and over again. In that pathetic story, rescued from the sea, there is a moral for all who go down to the sea in ships. Next time you go, pick your 8 records beforehand and be sure to have them with you. Because as you can tell from this tale, on a desert island, there can be no greater cacophony than to have, as Shelley almost said, the profuse strains of an unpremeditated 8.
We now go back to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his line was, there are fairies at the bottom of our garden.
Gardens. What's in them and how to recognise what's in them and how to maintain them. A lecture by F. Muir. If you look out of your window, the space between the window and the fence is what is known as the garden. And at this time of the year, the garden, you will see, is a riot of colour, green and brown. Now, green is what we've called vegetation. Now, if vegetation is composed of lovely things like plantains, which are little round plants of the banana family, and also daisy plants, which have little flat leaves, and that sterling plant, moss. Now, if if all these vegetations are growing so closely together that you can't see the brown underneath the green, that is called a lawn. Now, in order to help you maintain your garden, you have the advantage of modern technology, who's produced instruments, mechanical instruments. There's a thing called a motor mower. Most motor mowers have cylinders, rather like a little garden roller with teeth. You start a motor mower by turning the handle, by first tickling a little thing till you get a smell of petrol, then turning the handle for 22 minutes, and then getting the man from the garage. To cut hedges, you have an electric hedge cutter. This has a cable, and quite a good tip is to use this from a 12-volt car battery. You give yourself a hernia and are forbidden to garden for a year. Now, I was just discussing this with my wife this morning. We have 2.5 acres, and that, what you see, was built with these two hands. And I let go her hands, and I said, what went wrong? And she said, it is the dullest, dreariest, most boring garden in the home counties. And you know, this is absolutely true. With all my knowledge of gardening, there's just nothing to it. And this worried me terribly. And I was talking to the cast of our show about gardens, and they've all seen my garden. And they said, why don't you do something about your garden? And Anne said the simple answer, move. And Dennis said, no, I've got a theory that what your garden needs is movement. Why don't you turn it into a poodle farm? And Dennis said, no, it needs more colour. My theory is that you should get all that grass up, lay down concrete, and build an orange-painted, coin-operated car wash. But I found this terribly exciting, because, darling, if I may just talk to my wife, if you're listening at the moment, you know, the dreariness you see outside the window, it probably isn't just destiny. There might be a reason for it. You see, there are theories at the boredom of our garden.
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, the contest of the two stories is won by Frank Muir, but nevertheless, the entire contest is won by Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶
Thank you.